it's been a while since the last episode, and that's because it's been, as John says in this episode, a hell of a year. But this is also the year that marks the 70th anniversary of the Quatermass Experiment, the TV show that not only gives us our name, but also our whole reason for doing this thing. If you were lucky enough to be in North London on the second Saturday of September 2023, you may have had the chance to see some of the fruit of this year's labours, a celebratory live reading of the Quatermass Experiment shooting script at Alexandra Palace, site of the original broadcast. On the night of Friday the 13th of October this year, John met with co-producers Carrie Thompson and Chris Lentzay of Hermetic Arts, the show's Victor Caroon, James Swanton, and later on in the evening, script editor, compere and cast member Toby Haydock, to look back on a unique event. This is Bergcast, still the official podcast of the British Experimental Rocket Group, episode 35. Contact has been re-established.
Should we say who we are? Is that a thing?
That's probably, I'm John Deere, co-host of Bergcast. But anyway, I instigated and produced the live reading of the Quatermass Experiment. Next.
I'm Chris Lindsay. I'm a writer and director and of Hermetic Arts, and was brought on as co-producer of Quatermass Experiment at 70.
I'm Carrie Thompson, and I am an actor, writer, and the other half of Hermetic Arts, and I worked as a producer on the Quatermass Experiment with lovely Chris and John Deere. Oh, and I was in it as well.
Yeah, you were in it as well.
And I'm James Swanton, and I was delighted to be in the Quatermass Experiment playing Victor Caroon.
And we were very lucky to have you. So what, we're a month just over. This is now being recorded on Friday the 13th of October.
Yes.
Could go wrong.
So we're just over a month since we made Quatermass. How have people been in the last 5 weeks?
Just catching up on life.
Oh, right.
Yes.
I've been feeling quite empty. And I don't know, perhaps that's just because I'm like professional actors and other professional creatives and professional producers and the like. I had to go back to my day job. I've done things like have fan mail and sign autographs and have a lot of outpouring of love and positivity. You don't get that when you're doing policy work for finance companies. I've suffered a hangover from it, I think. It was so stressful and so exhausting. And then it was over. Is that normal? Is that a normal bottom out that artists, actors and the like feel after a production?
Absolutely. I think one thing that I would say, though, is that ordinarily with a show of that scale, with as many performers that we had and the size of venue that we had, that would just be the opening night. And then we could all relax into it. And not to say I didn't enjoy the day, because I did enormously, as I enjoy any opening night, but it was the opening and closing night. So yeah, it has a
that makes it sound like a disaster.
Yeah, it was absolutely panned.
Yeah, we were supposed to run for a month. It's a bit
How did I get you guys involved? Do you remember? Was it immediately after we did the Nigel Neal centenary? Probably I should explain that. April last year, so April 2022. I organised a Nigel Neal centenary at Picture House Crouch End, which was a day of screenings and panels. But to break that up, we had a live reading of Neal's lost radio drama, You Must Listen. Predates Quatermass Experiment, his second drama he's done, second radio drama. And though it was recorded, it went alive, but it was also recorded and subsequently lost. A lot of the story that's in that, and you may have heard Baffelgab's recent adaptation, concerns essentially a haunted telephone on the phone of, without spoiling it for you, the voice of someone dead speaking on the phone, a number of elements of which are revisited for a large audience 20 years later when he does the Stone Tape. Anyway, so Carrie was involved in that. She was the voice. She was passion fruit, that's it. I won't say buttercup.
I don't think she was credited as passion fruit in the
voice, isn't it?
Yeah.
It may just be voice, which when you're in a radio play seems unsatisfying. And at the same production, Chris also provided backdrops and bass sound and did an absolutely marvellous intro title sequence to the whole event, which is very good. But had we had the conversation about doing Quatermass before that finished, or did we talk about that afterwards? Do you remember?
I think it was after.
Do you remember, Chris?
I don't think it preceded the Crouch End event.
No.
Because, I mean, certainly with the Crouch End event, that was the first time we'd worked together. I think you'd seen some of our stage shows prior to that, and you knew us socially because we like each other.
I didn't know you that well socially before. Before we hadn't socialised individually. You were friends with my co-host on Birdcast, Howard David Ingham.
I liked to think of you as a friend, but I realise on your half that came later.
This comes as a shock to me as well. Yeah, actually, I thought
right, you thought we were friends before I thought we were friends.
Yeah, I think so.
Great.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I even knew your surname, or at least how to pronounce it, before the Crouch End event.
Nobody does.
Fair enough. Okay.
Basically, an acquaintance of ours, John Deere, asked us to be involved in the Crouch End production. Carrie, as an actor, I did video, graphics and audio. And after that, at least one of us wanted to be friends. And I think maybe you spoke to Mark first. Is that possible?
Yeah, I spoke to Mark. By the way, Mark Gatiss was also in the reading of You Must Listen. Thanks to Doctor Who and Star Trek novelist Una McCormack, who knew me from Twitter, basically because she likes my wife as a friend.
Or an acquaintance.
I asked her to be an early guest on Bogcast, and she went, no, I'd have to do too much prep. Fast forward a few weeks later, and she's on Matthew Sweet's program, Free Thinking, on Radio 3, talking about Quatermass. And I'm like, oh, you didn't do my show? And she's like, no, John, I didn't do your show. I didn't say no to the BBC, sorry. And Mark Gatiss and Steve Moffat were on that. And very kindly, she plugged Birdcast on the radio programme. And off the back of that, Mark Gatiss agreed to do an episode. And then we kept in touch in the widest possible sense of saying, you know, hello and Merry Christmas and things. And then he agreed to do the Crouch End event as a panelist and appear in the play readings. It was October last year I got commissioned for the Ghost Stories book. I pitched that and got a publisher, Ed Press. And that was about a week before he was shooting Count Magnus, because he invited me onto set, which was very nice. And so I said to Mark, just thinking aloud, if I organised a live reading of Quatermass Experiment at Ali Pally, and like one really wanted to be at Ali Pally because that's where it originated from. Now, initially I said to him, I thought maybe of screening the first two episodes and then doing a reading, a tabletop reading of the other four. That was my initial thought. But, you know, I haven't really gone into it in much detail. However, I said, if I did that, would you be interested? And he said, yes, as long as I could play Quatermass. And I said, that's a shame because I'm in Quatermass and I'm not sure I could find a part for you. But he persuaded me eventually. And that was great. Now, reality hit because I'm asking him a year in advance to be free for a day that we don't even have a date for yet. But he said, obviously, I can't 100% commit. If, you know, there's reshoots on Mission Impossible, I can't tell them to sort of because I'm doing your reading. But can you go see as late in the year as possible to do it? It's the anniversary of the Quatermass Experiment, but it's the first episode is in July. But I wasn't too fussed about being on the day as long as it was that year. But the latest Ali Pally could do was the 9th of September.
Which is great, because when John said that it had to be as late in the year as possible, and probably September, I said, yeah, absolutely fine. Just please don't do it the weekend of the 9th of September, because that's my 40th birthday weekend.
You have a very memorable 40th birthday, Carrie.
I do. Thank you for that.
Yeah,
and no way stressful.
Ali Pally were quite up for it, but initially I thought we couldn't do it. You had $6,000 to hire the theatre, and this is entirely self-funded. There's no money provided. BFI were very kind in giving support, but no cash. So I didn't think, and I wasn't prepared to risk, you know, I'll spend what I can afford to lose, and I couldn't really afford to lose $6,000 on this as well. But we went back and forwards after I'd said, I'm sorry, we just can't do it. And they pointed out, and I wish this was well planned by me, but it wasn't, that it was Ali Pally's 150th anniversary. So they really wanted to do something to celebrate the fact it was where the birth of television was. So they said that fits with us quite nicely. So we did a deal and they gave us the theatre for far cheaper than they otherwise might have done.
It was amazing. If I can just say, the day we went to Recce, the theatre, just to have a look, and kind of go, I just remember walking in and thinking, this is huge. And knowing from the two previous events that we'd done, I think there was Derby, which was a few hundred, couple of hundred, and then there was Crouch End, which was a similar size, and then to go from that to this enormous theatre.
We sold out Crouch End, that was like 150. Mm-hmm. Derby, it was, I mean, that was tough. There was probably about 40, 50, I think, that actually came on the day, particularly by the end, because there was strikes and things like that, and it was quite late. So the idea of doing it at a theatre pushing 1,000, I remember thinking, we're not going to sell it out. If we can, like, you know, get 400 or 500, it will look all right. But it has a sort of beautiful faded elegance, sort of crumbling Gothic charm, the theatre, if you haven't seen it. Yeah, I remember when we showed around and that how deep the stage was, how far back the stage went. And it's still got that, the original, although not usable, but the lighting, isn't it? Mm.
Yeah. The house lights, I think, originally worked by altering the amount of water resistance in big tanks. I sort of understand the physics. I don't understand the health and safety aspect. But yeah, it's a remarkable, remarkable building. And it does look a little bit like it might fall down on you, because it is listed and there are things that they can't do. But I'm assuming you never felt under threat from the ceiling.
If you've not been, Alexandra Palace, the whole complex, not just the theatre, which is relatively recently renovated and rediscovered, basically. Mm. But it's a vast space and not easy to get to in terms of, it's in Muswell Hill in North London, which isn't on the tube. You wouldn't build something that size now in that location. I mean, certainly not as an entertainment complex. It's sort of permanently needing renovation work. It was built in the early 20th century. But now it houses vast concerts in its main hall, ice hockey, lots and lots of exhibitions.
I wanted to ask James, actually. Obviously, we'd recce'd the space. I'd already seen it and got a sense of the stage. But as an actor, was this your first time in that space? How was that for you?
It absolutely was my first time in that evening. It's rather overwhelming because, you know, even looking up the space on Google Images, etc., that doesn't really do justice to quite how monolithic and expansive it feels in person. And as you were discussing just then, the overall atmosphere of the place, Toby put it remarkably well when we first went in there, saying it was essentially if Miss Havisham was a building, which is a lovely way to put it, just this crumbling, peeling, Gothic grandeur it has. Yeah, there was a lot to consider that day. I mean, it was extraordinarily hot, and I think that was much more front of mind than just the space being cavernous. The fact it would be filled with extremely hot air. But it was all right as it happened. I think having the microphones and being earthed by the scripts and all of that, it creates a kind of protective barrier almost.
So we got together after sort of in theory agreeing. Toby Haydock had the camera scripts. You can find the camera scripts on the Quatermass DVD, but they're an absolutely terrible quality, almost unreadable. A script book has been in circulation since its original printing in the early 60s, but the script book is very different to the original camera scripts. Neil's gone back and tidied a few things and changed a few things. And I really, really wanted to do it as close to the original production. But Mark Gatiss was given the scripts, or at least he said he had episodes 1 and 4 given to him by Tacey Neal, Nigel and Judith Kerr's daughter, when Judith Kerr died and they were clearing the house out. Now, he said he only had episodes 1 and 4 and they were bound. And he showed us them. These are very thick. And they weren't the scripts for episodes 1 and 4. They were the scripts for episodes 1, 2, and 3. And the second one were the scripts for 4, 5, and 6. But Mark hadn't actually read them, I don't think. So it was crossed over with other areas. There was a nice M.R. James moment of going through this. We're going, no, these are the entire camera scripts, incredibly clear. So he gave them to Toby, and Toby transcribed them with a minimal amount of editing and changeover, just as so in some areas it was slightly necessary. But then we came together to, as in Carrie, Chris and I came together and Toby helped as well in the casting, because we knew that Carrie would be in it, we knew that Mark would play Quatermass, we knew that Toby would play James Fullerlove, but then we had sort of the rest, and you know, you've got a core of about six characters who appear in pretty much every episode, or at least all but one episodes. But then you've got another cast of about 60 characters over the course of the episodes where, you know, we were doubling up, but I wanted doubling as little as possible, but obviously you know, can't have 60 people in it. But we all agreed, I think, that the toughest part to cast would be Victor Caroon, because he's a constant presence in one form or another. On paper, Caroon is incredibly limited compared to on screen, where you could have, you know, do a huge amount with that as this constant presence, because Caroon is the humanity inherent in the story. But if you're just doing it physically, if you're just reading it, it can be quite thankless. You want someone who can instantly bring some physicality with very, very limited resources. And I think that's when you had an idea, Carrie.
Yes. Chris and I had seen James's show.
Yes, part of the London Horror Festival, where I believe you were also
and
presenting.
Very much enjoyed it. And
I think if you've watched any British horror film in the last 10 years, you'll know James's work. I mean, we'd seen him we saw him in Salt years ago with Alice Lowe, who of course was in Quatermass as well. We'd seen
We were in a film that we saw a couple of nights ago.
Yeah.
Very good.
There was no plan B. I mean, this was the shortest conversation in the whole process.
Yeah, but I think I said in the email, actually, that I sent to your agent, I said, I don't need to audition James for this role. We are confident that he can do it and would like to offer him the part immediately.
Mm. And I think possibly it was that very magnanimous offer to just, you know, present me with the role as opposed to audition me that made my agent slightly suspicious. It was one of those things that they forwarded with a slightly apologetic header saying, you've been asked to do this. They say it's not very much money. It's only one day. See if you're interested, I suppose. And the instant I saw it, I was like, but it's Quatermass. And it's Caroon in Quatermass. You know, it's the quickest I've ever said yes to anything in my life, I think. So I was very glad my agent did forward it on to me rather than make an executive decision.
They found a way.
Yes, yeah.
I think there were about three punch the air moments I think I had with casting, apart from Mark, because I think you... from the start of the book would do it, and that was Alice, Kevin, and James. Let's talk a bit about, as Chris says, if you've seen any British horror film in the last 10 years, they've almost certainly encountered your work somewhere. Do you want to talk a bit about how you got into acting and whether or not you always had it in to be a monster, or did circumstances take you that way?
Gosh, who's to say? I think like so many of us who are horror or genre enthusiasts, it was basically in my DNA. I must have been around 3 or 4 years old when I just became obsessively interested in anything macabre or gothic or vaguely spooky. So, yeah, as I became more and more interested in acting and performance, it only seemed natural that, you know, I would start to play parts of this particular nature. It sort of took a while to come round to it in a way. I remember certainly when I was at school and university, I was mainly sort of playing characters that were grotesque, but sort of comically grotesque or ridiculously grotesque. Yeah, it seems to be over the last 10 years, everything's just taken on a slightly darker hue, and I seem to play a lot of monsters, but I regard monsters as a great feast, and my sort of private personal conviction is that horror at its best is essentially the form that tragedy has taken on in the late 20th and now early 21st century. You know, it's the last forum, well, maybe not the last forum, but maybe the best sort of popular forum where you can tell these epic stories of great physical and emotional transformation and reconfiguration. The marvellous thing about Caroon is he is a monster and he's a human. You know, he is a perfect example of a monster with a soul. I think that's always the most interesting detail to try and tease out of any of these characters. They're not human, but they could have been, or they once were human, or they have sort of trace elements of humanity inlaid in their monstrosity. So I was delighted when I was asked to do this. I really couldn't have been happier.
When did you first become aware of Quatermass and Nigel Neale then?
I was familiar with Quatermass insofar as I'd seen the Hammer films, but until getting involved with this reading, I'd never looked at the original scripts for the teleplay. I'd seen the first two episodes, the surviving episodes, but yeah, one of the lovely things about this job in particular was it was a great opportunity to finally engage with the original material. I'd seen all of the Hammer films, I think, in my teens. The first one I saw, and the one that I still love the most, going against the popular preference for Quatermass and the Pit, was the Quatermass Experiment. And so much of that was tied up in, well, first of all, the fact that I had no idea that Brian Donlevy wasn't what Quatermass was supposed to be. It was quite some time after I came around to Andre Morel in the BBC television Quatermass and the Pit and thought, oh my God, it could be such a good part. Whereas I think what Brian Donlevy does, it worked for me on the level on which I originally approached Quatermass, in that the Hammer version of Quatermass Experiment is an extremely dark and despairing and almost film noirish sort of piece of work. And Brian Donlevy brings that sort of very blunt instrument aura to the proceedings. But that film's heart is Victor Caroon, and you have in Richard Wordsworth a very underrated main actor giving the performance of a lifetime. It's an extraordinary piece of work. I always think of it as the halfway house between Boris Karloff in the original Frankenstein and Jeff Goldblum in The Fly. You know, he encompasses all of that torment and distortion and terror. It's a real tour de force, and I think even today, astonishingly underrated. I seriously wonder, had Wordsworth's performance in Hammer's Quatermass Experiment not been as brilliant as it is, and it is manifestly brilliant, I really do seriously wonder if that film would have been the success it was. Had it fallen on Donlevy's shoulders and the direction they could have gone in with the casting of Caroon, which might have been a stuntman or, I don't know, someone who had a strange appearance, a bit like Rondo Hatton in 1940s films, but couldn't really back it up with the acting. Had Wordsworth's performance not been as brilliant as it is, and had the film not made the impact it did, would we have had Hammer Horror as we knew it at all? Would we have had The Curse of Frankenstein? Would we have had the version of Peter Cushing we had? We would have had a famous Peter Cushing because of Nigel Neale and 1984. But, you know, Christopher Lee may have remained an unknown. It's terrifying to think of the impact that the Quatermass Experiment potentially couldn't have had and what we may have been deprived.
I think it's notable that he has no lines, unlike Duncan Lamont in the TV version, as we know.
This was another thing I took for granted. I had no idea until...
Oh, you'd have lines.
Well, I had no idea until sort of doing some research and reading, particularly Andy Murray's book years later. But, oh, and of course, seeing the surviving two episodes. Oh, Caroon does have lines. It's, yeah, it came as something of a revelation to me.
But that was often Wordsworth casting, wasn't he? He plays, like, even though he required no physical transformation at all, it's like Hammer's Camp on Blood Island. He plays an emaciated, tortured prisoner by just basically taking his shirt off. That's the image that's used on the...
Yes, yeah.
Even though he's only in, I think, only in about two scenes.
And of course he was brought in to do The Curse of the Werewolf a few years after the Quatermass Experiment, and he's essentially just doing a Caroon in miniature. He's in the prologue of the film as the werewolf's father, and he is reduced from passably human to monstrous beyond repair in about a 10 or 15 minute stretch in that film.
Are those sort of performers you've always admired? I know I've spoken to you before about Karloff and...
Oh, yes. Yeah. Enormously so. I think a really serious moment in me becoming condemned on a sort of full-time basis to be an actor was seeing Lon Chaney in The Phantom of the Opera when I was about 11 or 12, and I was just so transported by the theatricality of that and the commitment to creating these grandiose images, and again, the emotional heart, the fact that is a monster with a soul. I think that probably had more impact than any one thing. And of course, once you started looking at Lon Chaney, you do come to Boris Karloff, you do come to Bela Lugosi and Peter Cushing, Christopher Lee, all sorts of adjacent actors who dipped their toes in horror waters, like Claude Rains and Charles Laughton and Peter Lorre, but who never became completely identified with the genre. And yes, it's very hard for me to be meaningfully specific beyond Lon Chaney. It's all spread out in such a kind of all-encompassing way. I was quite powerfully transported back to that doing the Quatermass experiment last month, because first of all, Linda Marlowe was there, and it was with Linda that 8 years ago I performed Sykes and Nancy, Trafalgar Studios on the West End. We had a double bill that was loosely titled Dickens with a Difference, and Linda was the first half of the bill with her show Miss Havisham Expectations, and then there would be a half-hour break, and then I would do Sykes and Nancy afterwards. So, yeah, we'd had a past experience of working alongside each other, but not actually with each other. You know, we hadn't acted in the same thing, but we'd been breathing the same air and occupying the same space. So it was really, really lovely at last to actually have scenes with Linda. Not dialogue-heavy scenes for me, but, you know, we were actually characters in the same piece. But apart from all of that, the seat that was hatched for Caroon's last stage transformation when he's in Westminster Abbey, that very closely aligned with the sort of utterly maniacal stuff I took it upon myself to do in Sykes and Nancy. Utterly, utterly mad and deeply inhuman. And for that reason, very appropriate to a character like Caroon. So I had done Sykes and Nancy in a very physically involved fashion. I'm glad to have survived Sykes and Nancy and not to have been completely broken on the wheel of it. It did come back to me very, very vividly doing the finale to Quatermass. That old, familiar, slightly sickening but exhilarating sensation of it's beyond my physical capabilities and it's still going on and it's really exciting, but oh my God, it's one of those things where I think the thrill of it for both the performer and possibly for the audience, it's sort of a tightrope act. It's the idea that, this is sort of a bit beyond what we can reasonably ask anyone to do. That's certainly how it felt doing it. I think given the massiveness of the space and the fact I was quite far away from people, probably less than that for the audience. But it was very exciting. And I was dressed quite similarly to how I'd been in Sykes and Nancy, just the sort of basic, I suppose, Bukowian black. Almost. So that brought it powerfully back to my memories.
Should we talk a bit about what that end was? Because I know when discussing the script, how you present the climax to the Quatermass experiment did present a challenge because it's very wordy. Quatermass talks the amalgamated creature to death by appealing to its latent humanity, Linda, although we will never know because we can't even see or hear any material other than a single photograph or those several photographs of the model shot of the creature itself. Chris and Carrie, do you remember how that was approached and how we would present that to the audience?
Well, Chris has a great mind for all aspects of theatre, and just the very simple idea of having a light on James as he's giving his Caroon and then forming this huge shadow on the upstage wall was such a simple idea, absolutely brilliant. And then I had the joy of in the day going up to James and kind of trying to explain. It was really hard actually, James, because I was like, I just want to kind of go, just do, you know, you're very good. I don't want to tell you how to do your job, but you know how your body moves so much more than anyone could. And you're so in control of that. I just knew you would be able to do it without me having to explain.
It was one of the funniest moments of the day when you informed me I was about to do that, because I had sort of idly wondered before, but I hadn't actually had the presence of mind to send an email or inquire more deeply into how this might be accomplished. The second I understood what you were getting at, Carrie, I was delighted. I think as well it's the sort of thing where it's slightly deadly to over-rehearse it.
I think I should clarify for the, our dear listeners.
Oh,
so the majority of the cast didn't meet until the lunchtime on the day. This was not a project that had the budget or resources to have a lengthy rehearsal process.
Or even a particularly short rehearsal process.
Or even a short rehearsal process. There was no process. Almost no rehearsal. And the cast were given their scripts individually. I think, John, you spoke to every cast member individually. Is that right?
That's right.
I don't know what happened to these conversations.
We were talking, basically, yeah, it was going through as much the logistics and going through the part. But obviously, experienced actors were able to read it. And you know, Alice said, I think I know what I want to do with this part. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a huge amount of time. I mean, and also, most of the parts it's only Robbie Woody James that has any greater considerations in terms of the performance. With everybody else, you know, it's like, you know, Dan Starkey was a highly experienced radio actor. You're playing multiple, quite small, even though they're fleshed out well by Neil, they're still quite, you know, they're quite, in individually, they're quite, you know, limited parts. So experienced actors know what to bring to it, you know, as you see. I certainly didn't say to Alan, can you milk every last single line from the park keeper and from the cinema manager, even if we're running disastrously behind schedule, could you go as slow as you could just to milk every last laugh?
It was worth every second.
Oh, yes, yeah.
You see, you're Cox. Excited by Kevin McDally and Alice Lowe, Mark Gatiss. I'm just there for... One of the sassiest men in show business. Alan Cox is a dear friend. We'd actually worked with him a few months ago. We'd done some filming with him, and I may even have mentioned it to him then that we were doing it.
My very first introduction on a live basis to the performance art of Alan Cox, and it was a wonderful experience. What was that word as the park keeper that he pronounced so
Idsmus,
pointedly?
Idsmus.
That was it.
Yes.
I can't even say it.
Idsmus.
Only Alan can say it now.
This is what's lost when you can only read a production. You can't see what an actor brings to it. And you as a non-actor, so I'm not talking to, I'm going to talk to Chris. Or,
you can talk to me, that's fine.
Yeah, no, but you have some experience of this regardless. But as a person reading upwards that, you won't necessarily draw out perhaps what Nigel Neal had in mind when as characters. And the Quatermass Experiment, like a lot of Nigel Neal writing, is quite funny. Mm. Nigel Neal heightens horror by creating verisimilitude and world building and tiny characters that mean something, generally because they're obsessing over the minutiae of life. And the idea that the park keeper would interrupt an unsuccessfully courting couple to inform them at great length, whether they want to or not, about ornithological matters and the isthmus, not the island.
He knew what he was doing.
Yeah. Oh, he did. But we'll never know exactly what the actor did with it. I like to think there was certainly humour intended by that. Whether there was the amount of humour in it that Alan was able to get, which is nothing other than a huge compliment to Alan. And also, unlike in television, a live reading, where you can react with the audience. Toby.
Hello.
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 I'm overdue by 57 hours.
So, Toby, you basically had the highly unenviable yet vital task of transcribing the Quatermass Experiment from either quite different script book, which was readily available, but as I say, there were a number of changes for what Neil put in between writing the script and rewriting it for the book, and the rather poor quality camera scripts that were available on the DVD. Did you know what you were undertaking?
I mean, I've been through the script for doing the book, so I knew the differences were more than cosmetic. I think the received wisdom is, he's just tidied up a few of the stage directions, but other than that, it's pretty much as was. I think the pit one is a bit closer. Two is not quite the same. And experiment, the first two episodes are not too, but the Rocket Route was a bit different. But no, as I started to go through it, I was expecting to change a line here and there. It was also the practical thing of I didn't want to retype the whole thing because I'm not a very good typist, but I thought it would be the odd tweak here and there. And as I went through it, it changes practically every line. And there are some scenes that are completely different and some where I go, God, this is really different. And I type a whole page and then I'd go over the page and that page would be there, but he'd inserted a bit in the middle, which looked, and so it was, no, it was really, I hated it. It was really labor intensive. It was really horrible. But I mean, I thought what was really fascinating was that obviously there were going to be a lot of people there who, knew it from seeing the first two episodes, and that was about it. There were some people who wouldn't know it from Adam, but there was going to be a core of people who probably, as we maybe have, gone over the script book over and over again, certainly when we first discovered it and then at various intervals since, who would have a preconception about certain bits. For example, like the ending of episode three, which in the book is, the smash and grab. It's the, oh my God, he's been kidnapped by spies. Gunshot, gunshot. And oh my God, which of course I think is a more natural climax, but would have been a really hard scene to pull off on telly. My feeling is that they decided not to do that. I mean, there is a version of it, but not to have that as the big shock ending, because looking at some of those scenes, you could tell that anything that's got sort of fast movement tends to stay as a close-up on somebody who isn't moving, reacting, because you can't do a quick camera pan. So action scenes. So I think that scene would have probably been not the easiest to pull off, and so not the best scene. And you don't want to end on a moment of going, oh, that was awkward. So the actual end scene of episode three is perhaps something stayed in him, which isn't even in the following episode. It's a sort of grafted on moment of whoa, in order to go, we need a cliffhanger now. I knew that was there, but actually putting it together, you go, that is quite a big difference. And the bit between episodes three and four is hugely different, that 10 minutes either side. It was when I was changing every line from, because I used the script book as a basis, that I thought, even people really familiar with it, who think they know the missing Quatermass experiment to an extent, are going to be in for a huge surprise.
Were there any added scenes in the script book that didn't appear, or was it just reordering?
It was mostly reordering and sort of tweaking the dialogue, really. There's a huge bit in Judith has this really big speech in, is it episode three or four? Episode four, I think, where she sort of says, do you remember our friend who was in France? And blah, blah, blah. And that is purely there, I think, to give Briscoe time to get, because he's been in the previous scene with Quatermass. And in the script book is this lovely scene with an orderly who's trying to get Caroon to drink a glass of water, and he knocks it out of his hand, and I think something smashes in the previous scene in it, and it cuts to the orderly having the glass smashed out of the hand, and some very optimistic stuff there. I think I put in our script, didn't I, when I was doing the sound cues, there's a bit where the urchin screams and that scream then merges to the sound of a doorbell or something. I was going, are we going to try to do this? Because Nigel Neal thought they could, and I'm sure they didn't do it, but it is there in the camera script. So no, that was the starkest change, this really weird monologue from Judith that actually isn't very good. There's nothing like that in the script book, because he's clearly gone, oh. And there's a weird bit at the end of episode four where Fuller Love is in Lomax's office, and it's a short scene between Fuller Love, Lomax and Quatermass, where they're having a bit of a chat. And then next week, he's decided he doesn't want Fuller Love to be at the chemist's, because it's much more fun if Fuller Love breaks in and says, I want an aspirin and I found out these things. But he's obviously not gone back and changed that. So in it as broadcast, Lomax, Quatermass and Fuller Love are all together, and they get this call from the chemist, and Fuller Love and Lomax and Quatermass decide to go. Who knows where Fuller Love goes? And then he decides to follow them or something. And you go, oh, if you were rewriting that now, you wouldn't bother having that bit with Fuller Love at the end of episode four or whatever. So there were bits like that that just showed, I think, how quickly the script had to be put together, and how obviously when he's coming to the script book, he goes, well, hang on, let's iron that out. it's a very interesting exercise, but one that took a lot longer than I thought it would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, much like everything else.
Everything.
In this production. Chris and Carrie, do you want to talk a bit about the practicalities of putting a reading on? Is it as simple as here's a load of microphones, you've all got a script,
and then see you on the day?
That's about that easy.
It feels like it should be that. It feels like it should be that simple.
Well, I've seen it done where it is that simple, but generally that's because they're adapting something that's no more than an hour long.
Also, I think further to what Toby was saying about it being television, but being television in an era where they are more theatrical scenes, it's almost that period of transition from TV being a play with lots of long scenes where people just stand in drawing rooms, and modern TV as we know it, where every scene is 30 seconds long and everybody has one word. And what I think you realize when you're staging it is that on TV, this version of Quatermass, you can focus in on one character, two characters, three characters. But so many times as we were going through the script and working out the blocking for it, we'd realize, oh, these people are still in the room. Like they haven't left. They are, we need to keep them present. They haven't left. But I think that's something that on TV, you can cut to a two shot, you can cut to a close up, and not worry too much about the fact there's a room full of people. But we're doing something that is semi-staged, as in we can see the cast at all times. And so, the blocking just became a... I mean, we use software. We had blocking software to work out where people had to be by their microphones. It took...
Wow. We did try to do it with little pieces of paper and realised very quickly... But it just got out of control and it had to be digital. Mm. It was a huge job. It was fun though, because it really gave a sense of how we could create scenes and groups in various spots with mics, and Chris did an excellent job with different lighting states and the very existence of the off-ex mic for when people were doing radio things. It really elevated the whole performance in the end, I think.
There's so much that Neil puts in that is now a staple of TV drama or film, even, that we see for the first time here. So the idea of the flashback dissolving into the here and now, mm-hmm. rather than hearing it on a screen. So as we then move Reichenheim, Karuna, Green from the effects mic to the main mics, which then means everybody else has to step back. And I found it interesting finding scripting that halfway house between go and sit down and stand at the mic is stand back, but but just the technical aspect of that. And how that would need to be played. And so where you have the effects mic, where you have the telephone, where you have the radio, but also creating scenes within scenes, like Quatermass phones, Lomax, but then it's Quatermass in the room, so he doesn't need to be on the effects mic because he is talking on the mic. We're not hearing him on the phone, we're hearing him talking into the phone, which is different.
One of the conversations we had really early on, because we knew this was people standing at mics talking, like that was what the gig is. But early on, we were having conversations of, well, are we going to screen the first two episodes? Are we going to have video inserts? Are we going to put the Planet of the Dragons on a screen? Are we going to do something more elaborate?
Yes, I was really up for doing Planet of the Dragons as a pre-record.
And the thing is, I was really up for making Planet of the Dragons, but I also know that you have to pick your style. You have to say, look, what are we actually asking people to come to? If we start including video, where do we stop? This is not going to turn into a film. It's not going to turn into a fully staged production. So really picking the bare minimum that will create the right impression. So again, with the effects, I mean, Toby, you sourced all of the music, almost every track they originally used, I think, with the exception of Planet of the Dragons, a comprehensive list of every sound effect. So that was the bare minimum, because you need that to guide people through it. It will feel very sparse without. There probably were about 200 lighting cues, but for 4 hours, that's not actually that many. It's reasonably simple lighting. And being really, really precise about which moments we choose to elevate. I knew that presentationally, the moments to pick out were things like the flashback with the three astronauts, because that is something so different from everything else. So that was lit in a way that is unique to that scene, and none of the other scenes were lit like that. The crowd scene towards the end, where I think, is that episode 5 or 6, but where the crowd builds outside Westminster Abbey. I knew I wanted to get a moment where everybody came forward from their seats and became more present in the space. Because I think even though it is a cast of 21, as an audience, you sort of ignore the fact that there are people sitting down in the back. You focus on the microphones, you focus on who's performing. And then there is this moment where the whole group comes in and fills the stage of Alexandra Palace, which isn't easy to do. And I think picking those moments, and again, obviously the end with Baines, his massive shadow, picking moments to give the audience a little treat was, I think, was important to me. But like I say, it was making sure it was the bare minimum. It was the things we had to do to elevate those particular moments.
I have to say, having lived with it all that time and envisaged it, and we'd had conversations, because when I was putting the script together, I was going, so is that Tannoy voice going to be a Tannoy voice, or is it going to come in? Is that that flashback scene, of course, was so important because it starts off being a voice on recorders and then it fades into the actual live action. You go, well, if they're doing it live both times, how are we going to do that? So, but you'd got all of that sorted in your head. And so that was a sort of bit of relief, and you're going, okay, well, they know what they're doing with that, so I'll put an approximation of how that works in the script, and I vaguely understand what they're going to be doing, but they've got that sorted. But when you turn around after a really long technical rehearsal where you've had to jump around a bit, and you get the idea and you've got the excitement, and you saw that climax, which I didn't know how you were going to do it. I knew that James was going to, as you're typing up Caroon, you were sort of going, yeah, but James is going to do, it's basically one of those terrible directions. It was tacit, but that I have had a direction like this in the theatre where the director's gone, Tote, can you just go on and do something? There were various scenes typing them out. And you go, but James Swanton's going to do something here.
James Swanton's going to be James Swanton in this scene, basically.
And that's fine. That's
go on and do the sort of thing you do.
Yeah.
I think actually, James, on social media, you said it's not very often you get the opportunity to go full Swanton. I believe that's crazy.
Well, it's that dangerous thing where you're thinking, I'm doing the sort of tightrope act. You're on the one hand doing the thing that makes you individual, and I suppose the reason why you're there and you were asked to do it in the first place. But there's always a danger of just becoming a terrible parody of yourself. And
I wondered after a while if you were writing James Swanton in human letters.
Not desperately. I hope not. I don't know.
That might have been the 30th night had we done a run.
Wait, yes, yes.
Start jamming.
A giant Y, a giant M, a giant C, a giant A.
To turn around and see that at the end of that, you know, long day, and by that time the curtain up was getting perilously closer, and go, oh God, wow. And to know that the ending was going to be more than I could have imagined, and I'd been, you know, close to the project we were talking about. I had no idea quite what you had got planned, and then seeing it there, I have to say it was a real thrill. And I was only seeing it from on the stage. I was so impressed and pleased with how you guys had come up with that. And it was such a surprise at whatever it was, 6:15. I was incredibly impressed by how you transformed what was envisaged as you know, like a live radio show into something that became a sort of live German expressionistic horror movie that's totally in keeping with the material, but totally breaking out of the confines of the way that we were presenting it. I was in awe of it. I think you all did an amazing thing there with that climax. And obviously the responses have said that as well, but just seeing it unfold that afternoon, having been so close to the project and had a vague idea of what I thought it might be like, it was amazing. Well done.
I have to add that I didn't give it either for the ending. So, you know, all credit to Chris for hatching that and then pushing me in that direction. I don't think it would have occurred to me.
No, I thought you were going to sort of stand there and pull a face, you know. I thought that.
Yes, yeah. I, to be honest, had a mental image of me stood there quite impassively as Quatermass was, you know, unburdening himself of that last speech. I didn't have any conception that it would be anything baroque in the end, but
yeah, it was beautiful.
Yes, I was so pleased because you know, had it even occurred to me, I think I'd have probably thought, oh, that's too much. So it's always good to be surrounded by other people who have convictions that you yourself don't.
Well, the other thing, and I think I said this in one of the emails to the venue when we were discussing the lighting requirements, is the reason we're doing it there is because that is where it was broadcast from. And I really wanted to make sure that we were celebrating the building as much as anything else. And we held off, if you didn't see the show, but most of the action was quite far downstage of proscenium arch. The upstage area was kept in darkness. So not only was that the first time we were seeing Caroon filling Westminster Abbey, it's almost the first time that we'd really got a sense of that huge stage, the huge wall behind them, and utterly beautiful building. It was also a celebration of this great, wonderful, haunted space.
Of course, if we had filmed Spaceman and Space Girl and had that projected, then none of that would have been possible.
The reaction to it is something that will stay with me, probably for the rest of my life, if that isn't too pretentious. And again, unlike, you know, Carrie and James and Toby, my onstage experience doesn't much go beyond the Swaffham Players and the Staffordshire University Drama Society, which didn't quite prepare me for the reaction at the very late climax to those that had stayed, and thankfully the majority did, nor to the outpouring on social media and the reaction since. Were you guys surprised by that?
Well, I had the advantage of going on first because you very kindly let me do a sort of scene setting introduction.
Yeah.
And of course, walking out there, I mean, it's such a proper use of the word awesome feeling. You walk out there and it is a big space. Even when it's empty, it feels very, you know, you feel like you're filling the room, even though you're dwarfed by it. It's at the same time. But walking on, before I got to the microphone, there was a massive round of applause. And it made me feel, oh, everyone's here for this and everyone is on board. And then a couple of little throwaway lines in that very short introduction got quite big laughs, and I hadn't gone on to try and be funny. They were only light, you know, light bits of phraseology. They weren't gags. And I got a real sense, even before we started, therefore, that, oh, there's a real sense of anticipation here, which, of course, there was, because the people coming were real aficionados or certainly so sympathetic to the material. And you could feel it in the room. And that was like an extra character, really, because people tend not to, unless it's, you know, unless it's a long Shakespeare play with really famous or very accomplished Shakespearean actors in it doing something that's been rehearsed for ages, you know, people tend not to sit on their asses for four hours or whatever. And we really felt bound together by them. And I think under other circumstances, you know, we might have been going in the interval, Christ, we're going to have to cut a scene or an episode. This is dragging. But it wasn't dragging. It was long, but it never felt like it was an endurance test. The people that left because they'd got buses to catch, not because they were bored. I felt really amazingly supported by the audience in that room. And then, you know, the outpouring the next couple of days was extraordinary. And I was desperately sad. I was unhappy for, I still am, really. The come down has been massive. And that's partially because I think you felt in that room, you were part of something that, and I had to occasionally think to myself, soak this in, because this is not happening tomorrow. This is now. You've got to remember this. This is right now, and this is never going to happen again. And this group of people are never going to be together again. And we're not going to be doing this project apart from right now. So don't, you know, don't forget to appreciate it while it's happening. And don't panic that that it's 11:05 and we're still on episode one or whatever.
So what I really loved, one of my lasting memories of the show, is just sitting there on stage as John goes, episode 6. And there's just a laugh from the audience.
Like, I'd forgotten about this.
Yeah. One more. Come on, guys. We've got this.
Yeah. Too late to pull out now. It's too late to leave
but
now.
But he left. We knew we had to get through it. But it was so magic.
It wasn't just like going to see some show. It was, you know, you want to use words like it was like happening. It was this incredible concentration of goodwill. But like you say, it is a unique event. You know, you often come off shows and go, oh, that was special, that was wonderful. And a lot of shows are special and wonderful, but this unified 700 people in a way that certainly in a way that I've never had the opportunity to be involved with before. And the fact that people came out buzzing, you know, came out so excited to have seen this unique experience.
Yeah, I think in all my years as a performer, I have never seen, I mean, I've seen audiences walk out. I've never seen the show finish. A huge, amazing standing ovation, but then those with very pressing transport needs rushing from the theatre, but applauding wildly.
Skating out.
And I don't think I will again. It was really special.
It meant so much to the cast, it seems, as well as the audience. Like, I got fan mail. I've had things to sign. That doesn't really happen to me. We made something amazing. And I've still not processed that properly. When I did the Neil Centenary, I had a massive come down because I did something and it worked and lots of people helped. And it was brilliant. And, you know, Carrie worked and Toby emceed and, you know, Chris made fantastic visuals. And it was a lot of effort, and it worked, and it was great, and it was fun. I had a huge come down the next day. I just didn't really know. I had lots of pent-up emotion, and which I didn't really know where to go. Similarly, I had adrenaline drop, and, you know, to do with it. But this was a different scale altogether. And here and now, over 5 weeks later, I'm probably not processed what we did, and it's like. My wife has noticed that, you know, my mood has been slightly more somber. And that isn't that, I don't think that's anything, that's saying something from me. And it's the price you pay. It seems to be the price of creating something or helping create something so magical as people have talked about it. It feels hubristic to say that, but that's a word that people have used and I'm for. But it's the price is... I don't know what to do with myself now. Because, you know, as Carrie said at the beginning, it wasn't the first night. It was the only night. You didn't get a run of this to deal with. Get into it. Have better, have worse performances. Find a level. Find a long camaraderie. We were there together. It's almost like, you know, we're in a hostage situation.
Well, the audience were.
Yeah. Now we'll, and you know, that group of people most certainly will never be in the same room again.
It was really singular, even for those who do perform, because I think some wag on Twitter or online somewhere, run up to the event, it's going to be like the Woodstock of Quatermass. And it really kind of was. It was particularly borne in on me right at the start after Toby had made his speech and Mars Bringer of War came on and we all processed on, you know, 20 odd of us, and the audience were mad. I couldn't believe what was going on. I felt very safe and also a bit scared and entirely excited from that moment on. It was remarkable. I've never known anything like
that. We got David Tennant to record the intro.
Yeah. Pass. Forgot about that.
One of my favourite bits of the day, because I was sitting two seats down from Tom Burgess, and when Tennant's voice came in, I just happened to have looked across at Tom. And of course, he had no idea. He had no idea. and he looked at me and the look on his face. And so it wasn't just that you're going, oh, this is unfolding for all of us. We're going to see what each performer is like, because we knew who everybody was, but we didn't know what they were going to do. I didn't know if Kevin McNally was going to do Lomax RP or not, and all those little things. So you're just sort of looking around. And for us as creatives, what everybody else was bringing to the table happened sort of live in front of our eyes, as did that moment where David Tennant's voice comes in, because we were all quite excited and we knew it was going to happen. But of course, we hadn't told anybody else.
And there's no time.
And so even the sort of tech, which is normally the, you know, the real sort of graft and grind, had moments of little bits of magic sprinkled over it. And I will never forget the look on Tom's face. And it was wonderful. But I think that's a sign of how
high we were aiming. We'd got we'd got a good show, and we were talking about, you know, well, there's this voice at the beginning, and in the thing, it's John Glenn who plays Briscoe in the original. So we could have gone, well, let's be authentic and get Charlie to do it. And that would have been no bad thing, and a lovely way to start, and it would have been apposite. But we just went, yeah, but what if we could get someone who can't be there? Surely that's going to be better. Make a virtue of the fact that it's probably going to work best pre-recorded. Let's add an extra thing. And we've got loads of work to do, but I think it was that collective ethic of going, well, if we can make even this bit, these five lines special, let's try. And, you know, we tried, and he said yes, and he did it. And what a way to start. And I think that then says to everybody who's sitting there going, well, I think this is going to be quite fun. Oh, right, it's going to be even more fun than we thought, because they're doing stuff like that. And I love the fact that we didn't sit on our haunches at any point during the prep, and let's try and see how we can make that as good as it could possibly be, you know. Especially as everything else that we're doing, we're going to try and make as good as we possibly can, but we're going to have to do it essentially in the moment. Whereas at least these bits we're doing beforehand, we can add some sort of finesse to, because the rest of it was by its nature, you know, out of the starting blocks and sprinting away.
It was also,
I think what I really enjoyed is, you know, when you approach people like David Tennant or Mark Gatiss, who says, I want to play Quatermass, there is that wonderful, it's not just, oh yeah, sure, I'll do that for you. They're like, I get to play Quatermass. and David Tennant is like, I have to be involved. Like, it wasn't just a, yeah, sure, I'll record this for you. He was excited. And that's lovely. Quatermass sort of does that for people.
Yeah, Mark's text was, you'll make an old man very happy.
Well, of course, that was the very, because it's a horrible thing approaching, but we were sort of emailing people we vaguely knew. Oh, I've interviewed Kevin McNally, but I've never, you know, I've never asked him to be involved in something that's, but and it's very different to ask somebody to give an interview than it is to say, you know, that job you're really famous for, I can't approach your agent, because we sort of largely knew it probably wouldn't get through agents because of the nature of it, and because the personal touch always helps. So that's a very different kettle of fish, and you it's so easy to forget, because I thought you'd have to pussyfoot around everybody, go, oh, could you, it's really, sorry. And of course you do that in the email. You go, would you mind, and they go, oh, this sounds really good. Yeah. And the only reason people wouldn't do it, and the only people who didn't do it that we asked to do it, who didn't do it, couldn't do it because they were at a wedding. There was nobody that went, I'm not doing this small, crazy, not very big budget job because I don't want to do the job. And actually, we only got turned down by a couple of people anyway, but they were people who couldn't be there because they were away. Everybody loved the sound of the project and wanted to do it. And there's a couple of people who were really gutted that they couldn't do it because they weren't around. And that was a surprise, because that was an anxious time, wasn't it, when we were trying to get people. And again, we aimed really, really high, but actually it worked.
We got a news night.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, Toby, do you want to quickly mention how that came about?
Well, I'd been asked to go on Newsnight to talk about the 70th anniversary of Quatermass, because one of the in-house producers at Newsnight, Stuart Denman, is science fiction nally inclined. He's a fellow traveller. And I think he'd initially just go, well, we'll get him in the studio to talk about it, and it'll be the and finally piece. But I mentioned to him that we were doing the wonderful, oh, what a day, reclaiming my wedding anniversary from the sad, because I'm a divorcee, and my wedding was on the 18th of July. Quite by coincidence, by the way, I hadn't decided to get married on the day of the Quatermass experiments. Anyway, that's aside. So we were going to do that walk around Valley Pally on the 18th of July. And so Stuart had said, can you come into the studio on the evening of the 18th of July? And I said, yes, absolutely. We'll talk about Quatermass. And I just said, well, you know, we're going to be at Ali Pally in the morning. And he went, oh, okay. But it didn't look like it was going to be that sort of a budget of a film. It's going to be, let's just get somebody in. And if we've got 5 minutes at the end, they'll talk about Quatermass. And if we've got 3 minutes at the end, we'll do that. And we might just have 1 minute and a clip. But for whatever reason, he went, well, let's try and do as good a job of this as possible. And he came along to that and filmed us at that. So then it became a package of us going round and doing clips and then the studio discussion as well. So it went from being, I think, a small and finely to being actually a, quite a hefty piece. And I suspect if, you know, if war had broken out on that day, they might have dropped some bits of it or others. But we actually got 10 minutes. Mm. That was purely, it was one of those things where the stars align, because they hadn't planned to do a video piece on it, I don't think. And no. I just sort of suggested it because it would be good publicity. And I thought it might appeal to them. And it did, and they did. And I mean, it was the icing on the cake for that day. Yeah. It's 5 weeks later and we're talking about it. And I'm quite emotional about it, because it had that day, which was the 18th, which was beautiful. We got to go around Alexandra Palace where they actually did it on the day.
I mean, we should say we didn't just do it in the theatre. We were taken to the BBC studios, literally, where the...
Yeah, on the day, on July the 18th, when episode one of the Quatermass Experiment was rehearsed and recorded from Alexandra Palace, studios A and B, we were in there. We walked in the footsteps with Mark, with Linda Marlowe, and it was so special.
And we're tasting meal with Nigel Stoughton.
And the monster, Victor Caroon, was
and
there.
And we brought the original prop with us as well, yes.
And you're just going, and Mark brought the camera script.
Yeah.
It was such a special day, that. And that was before we'd even done it. And I think that was when I thought, I know I'm going to like doing this. It will be a pleasure to say those words and be in that thing. But that was when I got the inkling of, oh no, this is more than that. This isn't just a performance. This is almost like a sort of resurrection. I treasure that, the memories of that day, and the fact that we've got a tangible record of it in the Newsnight report is really nice. It was a good day, wasn't it, John?
It was an amazing day, and we're really grateful to Stuart for the effort put in. And you know, at no point in neither the film piece or your interview with Kirsty Walk was there any sort of sneeriness or taking the piss.
No.
It was treated with care. It was
really lovely that Kirsty Walk, when they were playing the VT in, went, I looked at those clips, it looked really good. And I thought, oh, good, she's not going to do any sort of sets wobbled and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. This is proper journalism. So because I've done a few interviews like that, and sometimes you have to be on the back foot and you have to make sure that you don't get annoyed with them asking you a fatuous question. It was none of that. You were able to actually do a nice little sort of totem for the show.
I just thought the last thing we did on that day, which was Chris taking as a low angle a shot as possible by literally lying on the floor with his camera, with you, Tacey, Linda Marlowe and Mark Gatiss, so we could get the aerial from Alexandra Palace in the same shot, and realising that, of course, Linda's dad will have been literally a few yards from where we were when he pre-filmed the spaceship sequences for
was in that car park. Yeah.
In the same car park, yeah, playing Peter Bathurst, playing Green. I'm not an overly emotional person about these sort of things, but we did a good thing, I think.
Charlie was one of the last actors to come on board. Charlie, who'd just come out of Coronation Street. And I don't think we're talking out of turn. You know, he wasn't quite sure what it was, and he was very it was really nice to witness an actor go, oh, I want to make sure I get this right, because he's much younger and not sort of, you know, versed in our stuff. And he went, so is this spoof? A few of the actors actually asked if it was going to be spoof, and we dispelled it, but Charlie actually studied the stuff and made sure that he was pitching the performance right. It was really nice to see an actor work so hard, do so much prep, and come and then deliver and do a really good job. And he was so pleased. In fact, I saw his partner last night at the theater, and she went, Charlie had such a great time doing it. And that was really, really, really nice, because he had no investment in it in the way some of the rest of us might have done. And he WhatsApped me the next day and said, so when are we doing The Creature? And I thought, okay, so this is a guy that's gone from having not even quite knowing what genre we were doing and whether we were parodying it to, you know, do it, knowing it chapter and verse.
Well, perhaps we'll meet back for the 75th anniversary in 2028.
I mean, you say that with a smile on your face. I'm deadly serious. Because there are things, of course, we would do again. The day after, as well as being sad, you go, oh, I wish we'd done that. And I wish
we'd do again, like a read-through before.
Yeah, so I don't see why we can't do them again and do them differently, but in 5 years' time. But I'm just the totty, John. You're the man with the purse strings. But yes, 75th anniversary.
With my brains and your beauty, we'll sort.
It was really special, guys. It was really a privilege to be part of.
I hope those of you that have listened to these slightly chaotic moments, and we managed to get Toby back from orbit. We'll probably put a bit in the show notes about what people are up to. Toby has a book on the Quatermass experiment coming out. Chris, Carrie, when's your film out?
We're in the edit at the moment on our first feature, Unfounded. It'll be somewhere in the world sometime next year.
Yeah, we're wading through rushes at the moment.
Yes.
Which is delightful.
We have hours and hours of wonderful people like Alan Cox, who we were talking about earlier.
Thank you all. And thank you all listening who came to see it. We really, really appreciate your commitment, your stamina, and the love we've been shown since doing it. It really did make a very tough project incredibly worthwhile. We really appreciate that. And we'll hope to see you in the future. Bye-bye.
Birdcast is an independent podcast presented and edited by John Deere and Howard David Ingham. You can find more information and show notes at birdcast.room207press.com. Thank you for listening.